Audio Publishers Association and the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities present Falling Headphones Over Heels, Audiobooks, recorded March 22, 2013, at the Jefferson Madison Regional Library in Charlottesville, Virginia, during the Virginia Festival of the Book. Well, welcome, everyone. All the heads come up. It's a wonderful crowd this morning. My name is Andy Arndt, and I am your moderator for today's Falling Headphones Over Heels Romance Audiobooks program. And with me today are Anne Flosnick, narrator, Janine Frost, author, and Elizabeth Wiley, also narrator. And I'll get to a little more detail about them in just a moment. I wanted to welcome everyone on behalf of Audio Publishers Association and thank Cheryl Herman and the board of Audio Publishers Association for their help in putting this panel together today. We couldn't have done it without them, and we're so grateful. APA is a not-for-profit trade organization dedicated to creating a public awareness of the audio publishing industry, as well as providing industry professionals with educational opportunities to develop their businesses. And they have a big conference coming up at the end of May in New York City. Thanks to audiogals.net for helping get the word out about today's event. Thanks to Robin Witten and her staff at Audiophile Magazine. And this is the part where I get to be Oprah. You all get Audiophile Magazine! She was generous enough to send several different issues. And so please, they are for you. They're our free gift to you. So, and bookmarks also from Janine. So take a bookmark, take a copy of Audiophile Magazine. The latest copy has Thomas Jefferson on the front. Pretty awesome. And you can learn even more than you maybe ever wanted to know about the audiobook industry. But you'll find reviews and narrator profiles and all kinds of helpful information in there. And of course, thank you to the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, producer of the Virginia Festival of the Book. And I've been lucky to be involved with the festival for quite a long time now. And so, welcome to Falling Headphones Over Heels. The audiobook customer, typical audiobook customer, is a frequent book reader who sees audiobooks as a way to read while pursuing other lifestyle activities, especially while traveling and commuting. But the increasing popularity of downloads means that audiobook listeners might also be exercising, relaxing, cooking, cleaning, gardening, crafting, walking the dog. People whose jobs involve repetitive manual tasks also report listening to audiobooks at work. So how many of you have ever listened to an audiobook of any genre? Okay, all right, fantastic, okay. Well, romance novels are extremely popular with audiobook listeners, and that's our focus today. So with me are narrator Anne Flosnick, an accomplished British actress with lead credits on stage, television, commercials, voiceovers, and 4 Audie Award nominations, including one this year for her reading of Anna and the King of Siam. So welcome, Anne. Author Janine Frost is an American fantasy author known for her work on the New York Times bestselling Night Huntress series. And the foreign rights to her novels have sold to 19 different countries, so congratulations. And her narrator is a woman named Tavia Gilbert, who's sent a little information for me to share today. And next to Janine is Elizabeth Wiley, also a seasoned actor, dialect coach, theater professor, and narrator. And in addition to her growing portfolio of audiobooks, her voice can be heard in The Idea of America, which is Colonial Williamsburg's virtual learning curriculum, as well as Paul Meyer's e-textbook, Speaking Shakespeare. So welcome to you. Today we're going to explore the symbiotic relationship between the writer and narrator when it comes to romance audiobooks. And as I said, Tavia sent some things to share about Janine. So... Tavia said, working with Janine's characters and stories is such a pleasure. How wonderful that she writes strong, self-actualized women, kind, thoughtful, strong men, and relationships that matter. I'm always excited to start a new book that Janine has brought to life because I know there will be great adventure, passionate love and war, and story that never loses its grip on your heart and soul. I hope I get to keep developing my relationship with Janine and her work. How lucky I've been. So what I'm wondering is what it was like the first time you heard your text creation out loud.
Hi. It was surreal because, you know, when you write a book, you don't think about the other formats that it's going to be delivered in. Really, you just think about getting the story out and hopefully not screwing it up. So the first time that I listened to the audio narration, I actually listened to it for about 30 seconds and then shut it off. It was too strange to hear my words read back to me. And it took me a couple weeks to listen to it again without that knee-jerk reaction of, wow, this is experiencing my story in a way I never thought to experience it through the, you know, the dramatic reenaction of it in audio. And so it was really interesting because it feels like a different... it feels like a different product, really. I mean, I wrote it, they're my words being read back to me, but it's just the things like where I might write, he said in a menacing voice, you know, the narrator kind of lowers her voice, makes it a little gravelly, and so it's kind of interesting to hear what I'm putting onto the page and trying to convey emotion for through the written word, the audio narrator taking that written emotional tag, for lack of a better phrase, and acting it out and putting it into a representation. It was really neat in a way. And I was just chatting and saying that it's almost, when I read the audiobook narration reviews to get a gauge of how readers have liked the presentation, it's almost like reading something that I didn't write because it's such a different product to me. They're talking about the narrator, they're talking about the accents, and they're talking about, you know, did this scene convey the emotion that they thought it did on the written page? Because a lot of times readers will, at least that I've seen, will read it and or in ebook and print and also have the audio file, which I think is great. So it's really interesting to hear the contrast as far as that goes. So it's neat and weird at the same time.
And for my narrators, when have you had the opportunity to work with the authors of the books that you're voicing, and what is that process like when you've had input and conversation with the author?
I'm Elizabeth Wiley again. I've been doing this for perhaps less time than Anne, probably a year and a half. My very first book was a romance, Cry Wolf, and I had some questions about character interpretation, and the publisher said, yeah, you can contact the author. So it was a really nice, developed a really nice back and forth about it, as well as the second book I narrated. The second book was based in Minnesota, where Andy and I are originally from, and I had some questions about how much they wanted to hear a Minnesota dialect, you know. Are we going all the way to Fargo or not? And so it sort of depended on the character. And those people I'm still in touch with. Most of the time, I guess, my questions go through the publisher that I'm working with, but I certainly hope to establish more narrator-author relationships. It's great when I can.
Hello, everybody. You may know my voice. really, it's been my experience that I haven't had too much backwards and forwards with the author, and most of the time I've worked it out on my own, and I have been very lucky to work with some authors over many years, but it's really just they've been happy with what I've done, and I've just got on with it and done it. Yeah. There was one time I did reach out to an author, and they were very busy and gave me some pointers, but it was a whole world-building thing. I was creating an alternate medieval Europe that was called something else. Very, very complicated. I worked it out.
Well, while you have the microphone, I'll go ahead and ask you then, when we talked before today, your sense of the process was very straightforward. I'm assigned a book, and I find out if people have accents, and I find out more about the character from reading the book, and I go. But you started to record audiobooks when it was more common to go to a studio, have an engineer, maybe have a director, and the audience may or may not be aware that increasingly narrators are self-directing and self-recording in home studios in a very solitary work environment. So maybe you can talk about how that work environment has changed for you and how you got into it.
a lot of questions there. One lady said to me, how did I get into this? And I said, just by going about my business, people would say to me, oh, gee, we love your accent. Where are you from? You know, and I'd say, I'd say your name. So Anne Flosnick. And they'd say, what? Anne Flosnick. Is that Anne? Yeah, it's Anne Flosnick. So that was really, I was a nurse and I wanted to make a career change. And this is not a profession that you fall into. I don't mean to make it sound that way in any way, shape or form. I work relentlessly day and night to have made my dream a reality. But it started somewhere and it started like that. And I wasn't even an actress and I got connected into the acting community. And then I very early on in my acting career became a Library of Congress narrator. 1996, that was where my career started. And I read all kinds of things. And just to show how, when I started off, the very first fiction book that they gave me had maybe, I'm exaggerating, 7 women on a page. I didn't have the skills to do that. And they said, well, it's just as well you came in a snowstorm because we're not going to, you don't have the skill to finish that book. Try this nonfiction one. And so I went on. So that's so long ago, we worked on tape. And when it came to corrections, and for example, with the first book they gave me, I had 60 pages of corrections, and they said, somebody will listen to this word for word, and you do them, and you don't get paid, and I did them. And because it was done on tape, you had to make your correction when you go back, it could be weeks later, make your character voices, and make everything fit in that time that it took to say it the first time. Which now, is you don't need it now that everything is digital, but it was a wonderful teaching tool for me. It just helps your skill and what you're doing and just being in control of your voice. So anyway, back to answer the question a little bit more directly. I started off then for years, I just worked with an engineer and myself. And so there was no direction from the get, I never had direction to begin with. And then things got a little bit, I got more busy and got some commercial work and I had to travel. And the first audiobook publisher that gave me a chance was Brilliance Audio, and I had to fly out to Michigan there, and then I had a director and a engineer. But I've always done my own research because I figure I'm speaking a foreign language in a sense, so I don't know, I've never seen the, and it's just part of my process. So mostly I have been on my own or with a director, but it's mostly been on my own, and now that the home studio thing has come about, and I still don't really do that. I work with Tantor, which is a proprietary program, and that makes it that I can do that. Otherwise, I travel to a nearby engineer, and we work for all kinds of different people. So mostly, I work on my own. And if you do work with a director, you know, and you've read the book, and being an actress, you have to be easy to work with. But sometimes if somebody's vision of what they want you to do, or even if you talk to an author on the odd occasion when they've wanted me to do something that I didn't feel would be best serving their intent, it can go not the best. So I'm fine working on my own. I suppose it's more what I've just become accustomed to. Does that answer that?
Yeah. Yes. And Janine, just to ask the question to you in the inverse, since you're on the other side of the equation, we talked just a little bit about Tavia asking you a few questions about pronunciations, that kind of thing. Can you talk a little bit about how that goes?
When my books were first contracted for audio, I knew nothing about the process. And at the time, Tavia, who was the narrator that was assigned, was told by her her bosses, for lack of a better word, you know, don't contact the author. And I'm not sure why, and she wasn't really sure why at the moment either. Maybe because there were difficult authors like what you said, and I apologize. Apologize on behalf of my breed. But a few books into it, she had gotten some feedback that she had pronounced a character name differently than I had told readers I pronounced it. And to this day, I still think she's probably right. I like to pull characters out of history and bring them forward in my books. And since I write about vampires, I can do that, which is really fun. Because if I find some interesting little historical tidbit, I will be able to say, okay, well, that character's a vampire and put them in modern day settings. So I did that with a character who was Pharaoh Menkaura, and who had the smallest pyramid on the Giza plateau and made him a modern day vampire. And the question was, how was the other historical representation of his name pronounced? I said Menchera's, she pronounced it, I think, Menkeri's. And readers went back and forth, and I guess she got some grief. And she came to me and said, you know what, they told me they'd really rather I not talk to you, but I don't want to hear this again from readers. So she's like, can I ask you about pronunciations and specific with accents? And I said, yes, please, I'd be happy to. And since then, she's probably regretted that, because she'll email me and she'll say, okay, these names, how do you pronounce them? And probably half the time I'm like, I don't know. They're 15th century, you know, dialect that isn't even spoken. Beats the hell out of me. So she's probably found me to be little help. But I tell her I pronounce them in my head. And so if any mistakes are made from, you know, a few books forward, it's me, it's my fault. and it's nice working with her, though, at least to get the input, because if nothing else, there's continuity between how I'm saying character names and how I'm picturing things, and then the representation for the people who do read the books print or e, as well as enjoy the audiobooks. And also, it's just, like I said, it's just interesting to hear her say, okay, well, you know, your character, Vlad, yes, that Vlad, yes. And that's never say never. I started writing vampires. I said, I'm never touching the Dracula mythos. And then 3 books into my series, guess who's on the page? But I didn't want to give him that Eurotrash accent. And so I was very specific, you know, that good evening sort of thing from the old Dracula movie. So I said, I want him to just have, you know, a very, very light hint of a, you know, would have been old Romania kind of Slavic accent. And so I was happy with what she did with that, because Dracula already, you have cheese in your mind with, you know, some of the movies. So I wanted to differentiate between movie Dracula and the historical figure of Vlad the Impaler, who really would not have been wearing a cape and you know, yeah, he's more like to kill you than hand you roses and talk with that kind of accent. So it was fun to be able to work with that and let my wishes be known. And it was fun to hear her input on what she thought of the characters. So.
Elizabeth, I have a question for you. Romances are largely written by women, and romantic audiobooks are largely voiced by female narrators, and yet the female brain and voice has to create credible, attractive, sensual men. Wow. So how do you do that?
Well...
It isn't necessarily about pitch. Although I do find that I tend to maybe pitch my female characters in the higher part of my speaking range so that I have the lower part of my speaking range available for the men, which is not to say that I want all, you know, if the female is a strong, self-possessed female with agency, I don't want to go in the direction of weakening her voice. So I look at different things about how I can differentiate characters. Sometimes it has to do with the cadencing that comes at the end of a phrase. And like President Obama has this sort of putting a period at the ends of his thought. You know, you have to also be aware that if you make a choice, not for it to be too repetitive, because the character has his or her own range. It might be a matter of timbre, of placement. I can do this more with sort of the side characters who are, if there's a quirky little guy over here who works for the maintenance or something, I could do something a little different for him that puts him in a little different place. You might work with tempo. A person who's has a high nervosity level, a costume designer, teacher of mine used to use that word. We can coin words. So if that inner rhythm of the character has that sort of high strung sense, that might inform how they speak. I do find that I sort of fall into a regular choice with the male protagonist. Sort of, well, you know, I sort of go with this mellow, seductive, sort of low range thing. But again, you know, I have to find out what the author has done to make each of these characters unique.
How about when those two characters, when your female protagonist and your male protagonist find themselves alone together?
Oh.
And sparks are flying. How do you handle it? You're by yourself when you're working, right?
I am by myself when I'm working. Well, that, you know, and that's a question. If it's written in third person or if it's written in first person, that's going to change a little bit, although I'm always considering whose point of view is this part of the story in, if it's in third person, because it changes. So I have to get the sense of that. If it's in the first person, I'll probably do a little more breath work with it. And I'm, you know, kind of building in the, like a good orchestral symphony. It has its crescendos, and you know, but you know, it's the rhythm of life. Just think about the flow of a story. You've got your exposition and your development and your conflicts, and then you work your way up to almost climaxes, and then the climax of the story, and then the denouement, and then the, so if you think of that's like the story of the book, well then those little things happen with every bloom of a tulip. Right? It's the circle of life, I tell you what. So, yeah, so I about, you record by yourself, right? Well, I actually, I'm very fortunate to work at College of William & Mary, and they have some very nice recording studios on campus, used a lot for music composition and film scoring, but then I go in there and record audiobooks. They have 9 studios. They all have glass doors. I usually try to choose the one on the end of the hallway so I get less traffic going past me. Because, you know, you have to really put yourself into it. And then, you know, I'm done with a chapter or a part of a chapter, and sometimes I just, you know, I need to go out and take a walk and get the, recover myself.
So, Anne, did you want to jump in on this one, creating men, your approach to creating male characters, or a memorable male character, anything you want to talk about?
There have been so many men in my life. I keep things simple. So, and particularly as oftentimes romances are going to be a series, I don't usually, unless the author has specifically made something very tricky, I'll just use that word as a basic adjective, I try and keep things simple. And that's usually, we start off with one brother and there's going to be another brother, so I keep paper lists and keep track. How did so-and-so sound? And just with words, I haven't got to the Garage Bandy kind of thing of making those kind of things. But I don't really do anything tricky because I think it would trap me, seeing as I've done so many, and then there's always another one comes along that was in a series, and what on earth did I do? So I keep it very, very simple, and not tricky in the sense of, and I'm not planning any breathing or anything, I'm just going along. I am there, and I'm seeing John, and I'm seeing Mary, and now I'm John, and now I'm Mary, and the whole thing, and it goes along, and it's natural, so I hope it doesn't sound forced. In that's all I'm doing. I'm just reading what's on the page, but I am there. There. Yeah.
If I can take a non-moderating liberty for just a moment, last week I was there. I work in a home studio myself, and I'm by myself. But we all know that sonic interruptions take many forms. So, you know, I have to stop and pause for a woodpecker, or your neighbor decides to chainsaw down a tree, or whatever. And last week, it was a first-person romantic situation, so it was, and then he did this to me, and he did this to me, and I'm there, right? And so I believe we had gotten to the hollow behind my ear, and a big garbage truck backed up. So I'm like right in it, and all of a sudden, boop, boop. Seriously? Come on, you know. Well, and Janine, you told an interesting story about a time when the audio gals, there's a website, audiogals.net,
And that's another place to find reviews of romance audiobooks and conversation about romance audiobooks. And one of the lines in their reviews has to do with the steam factor. And usually the reviewer just fills in, "Glad I had my earbuds in." But there was a time when you were on a bus?
Oh, no. Okay, no, no. Close. But there was a bus. I wasn't on it. First of all, let me say that if I had to act out and narrate certain scenes in my book, they would be very different. It would be, you know, they kiss, they went into bed, they shut the door, good night. The next day, and that's how it would be, because I could not do that. Like I said, I'm getting, like, blushy just listening to them talk about the process. I know! But I write it alone in a room, and I tell myself no one reads it. That's how I write sex scenes, okay? If I wrote with the idea that not only are your parents going to read this, your 86-year-old great-uncle is going to read it and say to you, "Salty." I mean, my scenes, they would be different, okay? I literally write them and tell myself no one's going to read this, and that's how they're written. So anyway. But one time I was talking to a lady who was talking about audiobooks, and she said, "You know, I found your books, and we were on this road trip thing, and I still don't know what event it was, but they were apparently on a road trip to some sort of romance convention, and while they were on this road trip, they were playing audiobooks in the background of a bus." And she said, "I had never heard of your books before, and everyone's talking, and we're all having a good time, and then all of a sudden, they started reading chapter 32 from your second book." And she said, you know, it, over the loudspeaker, and she's like, "And everyone in the bus got quiet." And she's like, "Until it was over, and then I ordered all your books." And I didn't know whether to apologize or thank her, or it's like I said, it's really different being the author and hearing. I was listening to that. It just, oh gosh, I want to hide sometimes.
Well, we do have time for questions from participants. So yes, question over there.
I wonder, when you narrate or when you write, do you see the character that you're playing? And if you do, when you see that character, are you seeing Johnny Depp? Are you seeing Mark Harmon? Or are you seeing somebody that you've made up? Or is it perhaps one of your neighbors you're seeing?
That's a very good question. And sometimes now looking online and I see authors who will have pictures of oftentimes British actors, fine young men that I've not seen, and they really are very, very handsome, and I think I should start seeing those people, but I don't. I see shadows. I can't really explain it, because there's so much talking goes on in a book, and it's, and I said it, I go backwards and forwards, and I do, but so I don't have time to focus on what does he look like and what does she look like. I just feel them. So to me, all I can say is they're shadows, but I hope that they don't come across as shadows. Because they're awfully naughty shadows if they do.
As a writer, there's very few times that I have a specific person in mind for a character. Most of the time, it's just I see them in my head, and people will ask me all the time, "So if your books were made into a movie, who would you pick? Who's the closest representation?" And I can usually only narrow it down to a blend of these three people. I think the only difference was Oded, I think I'm saying his name wrong, Ferrer. He was in Deuce Bigelow, Male Gigolo, as Anton, you know, the really hot-looking guy. Yeah, he's my Menzieres. Yeah, so when I think of Menzieres and I describe him, I am describing Oded at that particular point in his life. He's gotten a little older now, as we all do. But aside from that, it is just a compilation of figures in my head, and I'm writing as if I'm a fly on the wall and recording what I'm seeing onto paper, and that's how I picture the book and try and just put everything down that I see, which is why a lot of my scenes are detailed. The fights are detailed. If someone's head is getting cut off, I'm describing the blade going through the neck and the blood gushing. You know, the sex scenes are detailed because that's how I'm seeing it. And the dialogue, I think, is detailed as well because, again, fly on the wall. I'm just dictating what I see. And that's my process, but everyone's process is different, and I wouldn't say one way is better than the other.
This is being recorded. I can't possibly tell you who I imagine. No, seriously.
So it is your neighbor.
Actually, I don't see any specific
person, but I build that image out of what the author has given me, and then that visualization has to live in my head so that I can then communicate that picture to the listener reader. Interesting though, Angela Campbell, who was one of the authors that I was in contact with, asked me to do a blog with her on the 1 year anniversary of the book I did with her. And so when I went to her website and she posted some things about her characters, it was interesting that she was having celebrities in mind. She said, so-and-so plus so-and-so equals my character. So she'd take two and blend them, and for her that was how she visualized, or could explain to her readers anyway, how she visualized her characters.
Yes, front row at the end.
So I come from a broadcasting background, but not an acting background, and I'm a writer, and I've always wanted to narrate my own books. But my agent, her husband's an actor, and she's like, no, you never want to do that. It's an acting thing, not a broadcasting thing. Do you agree with that?
That's a touchy question. I know some writers feel so close to their work that it's like, that's my baby. I can't possibly let somebody else take care of it. And so I totally understand that desire to, you know, how could somebody else possibly understand all the intricate nuances of character that I've written? And having a narrator do your work is a little bit like, okay, here it is. I hope you do it justice. We always are hoping that we do the author's work justice.
Even the way that just legally, the way that the rights are handled, it used to be that the publishing contract dealt with the print publishing, and audiobook rights may or may not have been secured at a later date by whoever. And the way I understand it now, it's zipped up into one process, and so those audiobook publishing rights are part and parcel of the initial publishing contract. And from what I understand, authors very often don't even know. For example, I did a business book a couple of months ago and contacted the author when it was all done and to say, hey, thanks for a great book. I really enjoyed reading it. And he said, I have an audiobook? And so this is sort of the world. Do you have anything to add, Anne?
Sometimes with some authors, it's great. And others, it's like, well, I wish somebody else had done it. So you have to take it on a case-by-case basis.
You don't have to have static credentials to do it, do you?
No. You could be non-union and narrate an audiobook. That's true.
I would say I'm finding more and more that authors of their books are actually saying that they want approval of who the narrator will be, and I have to audition more and more. And you know, so you're put into a pot with other people. And as Elizabeth said, I would echo what you're saying there, that who's to say? Why wouldn't you be a good narrator as I? There's good and bad of every people, and everybody has a better natural ability or whatever, so there's no reason you couldn't. But probably, if you're concerned about who would be ultimately narrating your books, get the rights to the choice of who the narrator will be.
Yeah, just as an author, to briefly touch upon it, it's true. Before audiobooks kind of boomed, I think in the recent years, along with ebooks, you would sign a contract and audio rights publisher may or may not want it. And if they didn't, then your agent would try and find an audiobook company to see if they were interested and shop it just as if they were shopping a novel, and maybe people would want it and maybe they wouldn't. And if you're new, a lot of times they would wait to see how your book did before deciding if they wanted to shell out money on it. And now it's a right that publishers are grabbing more and more because they see that it's a growing popular, yeah, lucrative. Yeah, I was trying to avoid making it sound quite so mercenary, but yeah, that's it. That is it. you even if you keep your rights, that doesn't mean you can pick your narrator necessarily. I mean, if you're a top tier, if you're Nora Roberts, you tell them who you want, when you want them, and how you want them. But most of the average authors, even if another company buys your books, they'll say, we contract too, we want to have it done. And I wouldn't even know how to go about saying, if you want to have read your own. That was never a concern of mine, because, like I said, the audiobooks would be real different. But I can say that sometimes, after a while, they let you choose. When my Wright switched it from Blackstone Audio back to my publisher, they said to me, do you want to continue Tavia, or is there another narrator you want? And, you know, and they're like, we'll forward your consideration, not you get to pick, but we'll let you state your opinion and we'll decide if we want to agree with it, kind of. And so I said, no, I'm happy with Tavia, and then they kept Tavia. But sometimes they let you do that and at least give your opinion, and sometimes they're just like, here's your narrator, enjoy.
Well, I mean, I have a book with Simon Schuster, and not just sold the honor rights, just sold for that. But I digitally publish a lot to myself now, and so now there are outlets to do it yourself.
You know?
But yeah. I kind of wonder how long it takes to do it, and if it just is better to give your baby away, you know?
You can always find a studio where audiobooks are recorded the first time that you were to do it and experience the process that way, or even observe someone else in that process to get a sense of whether or not that's for you. Yeah. Another question? Let's see. Let's go way to the back. The gentleman in the back there.
Most of the discussion has been about drama or novels or romance. I'd like the panel to address the question of whether it's a different process for historical works, nonfiction works in general, but say historical works, whether the voices and the narrators are different, whether the difference between acting and, I mean, it's pretty clear that in romance or in many novels, it is a lot of acting, whereas is it more broadcasting in the case of nonfiction or business?
I've narrated everything, including magazines. yes, but within everything, even if it's a nonfiction piece, the author has a point of view. And everything that you read, I think if you're going to be successful as a narrator, you have to understand what you're reading and understand what is the author saying here and adopt the tone of the author, because every book even has a tone. Even if it's a historical tone, it's got some point of view about what happened. And it's coming at it from some angle. So you've got to kind of get yourself in sync with what the author is saying, because you're only there to serve the author. And even within a nonfiction piece, there are opportunities just not to keep droning on, because you don't want to be droned on, and what's the point in that? I'm reading it, so hopefully I'm bringing life then to that author's words and serving them as best I can. And there are often quotes too, and there's a school of thought that says just read them straight. I don't. If there was somebody, you know, the man from Ireland says, no, I'll give him a bit of an Irish accent and da-da. Just give it some flavor, and it gets into tricky waters sometimes, but that's, everything has a tone, so nothing is just blah, 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 and no matter what you're saying, you know, somebody fell off a cliff, you know, there's something going on. So yeah, you be aware of the rhythms, but mostly it's just everything to me is fairly simple. What is the author saying? And I'm gonna say it and bring it to life.
Absolutely, I agree with Anne, and just adding to that, I've enjoyed every book that I've narrated, and many of them are books I would never pick up to read myself, business applications and so forth. But because we have to understand the material so that we can make it clear, we have to understand the author's point of view, and the author obviously has a passion for that topic, or they wouldn't be writing a book on it. So it's our job to try to embody that enthusiasm so that we can communicate that to the listener.
Two different pools, narrators, or pretty much, if you're a narrator of audiobooks, you'll do most anything. Not want to, but...
It's a casting decision that has not so much to do with genre, I think, as sound, because it is an audio format, and so there are things that each of us are best for, in terms of our sound, and things that each of us are maybe not as well suited for in terms of the believability, credibility, carrying that information. Yes?
A simple question, so that you know what your author wants to convey so that you can be in it, do you have to read it yourself all the way through before you narrate?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
How many times?
One time, right?
So, yeah, I think most of us agree that we give it a good, thorough read all the way through so that you get the whole picture, you are able to grasp the tone of it, and then if it's a fiction piece, and sometimes I've read nonfiction pieces where they're using a hypothetical family to tell, to get the point across, knowing who the characters are and who's a, who are the characters who, if you're doing a series, to know who the characters are who are in the forefront or might be in the forefront in the next book and the next book, and knowing that those are voices that you can sustain and that a listener wants to listen to the whole time too. So yeah, I need to get the sense of the whole picture.
There was a discussion about this very topic recently in a, I think, a LinkedIn forum, and there's a narrator named Johnny Heller. And Johnny, if you're still listening to this recording, I'll buy you a drink at APAC. but he said, if you don't pre-read the book before you begin narrating, it's like trying to tell a joke without knowing the punchline. You don't know where you're going. So it's really important. And he said, I understand there are some narrators who just jump right in, but he said he doesn't understand that. So let's take a question from the front. Yes.
First of all, I wanted to say how much I appreciate the work that you do. I believe I'm a lifelong reader and a former librarian, and I believe that the audiobook is really a new art form. It's not reading, it's not watching a movie, it's in between. And it brings something different to the work. And I have read books, or listened to books, or classics that I've always admired, but could never get myself to read, and was able to listen to them, and a couple of them have been books I will never forget. Never forget. And so I just wanted to compliment you and say how much you add to people's lives by doing this work.
So you can check out Anne reading Anna and the King of Siam and then root for her at the Audi Awards this May. Yay!
But my question is, what do you do with a book that, not that you dislike, but that you don't quite... It's sort of outside your range of experience a little bit. You don't quite feel that you're on top of this. How do you handle that?
Laurence Olivier would have said, acting, dear boy, acting. you have to keep your personal, I keep my personal feelings out of it and just let the words take me over and serve them the best I can. Again, simple.
I oftentimes find that really digging in and committing to trying to understand from the inside out, I learn a lot. I learn an awful lot in areas that I had no previous experience with. And I suppose there are books that if I were offered, I would turn down, but I haven't had to yet.
Have you ever released a book under a different name?
No, the question, I think, you know, the question comes up, like, oh, well, if you had a really raunchy erotica piece, would you, you know, use your, you know, and there's there's the internet thing. Well, you would take your pet's first name and the name of the street that you lived on as a child, which would make me Nikki Heathcote, which I think is a good one.
I would be Dusty Windsor.
See, it works, doesn't it? But honestly, I think it's less to do with content for me than I want to read good writing. I don't want to read poor, shoddy writing. Right? Yeah.
Yes, red sweater.
We all know that romance audiobooks have been around for a number of years, but why do you think that it's just recently that we've seen such a boom in them?
Anne?
Money! Yeah, really, I think there has been an explosion in my work, so that's how I would gauge it. Now that there's all this less expensive digital content, and it's easier for people, and we're all oftentimes commuting, so we have a need to be plugged into something, because there's only so much radio normally people can take. They want to hear something different that they've chosen. So I think it's money.
I don't know. I've heard some theories being bandied about, and it's the same idea behind why is romance a really big seller in ebook. And I've heard some people say it's because women, you know, when they listen to audio or read an ebook, it's not like having a cover like this, where people might question you or judge you. And that angers my feminism, because who the hell are you to tell me what to read? But at the same time, you know, there are some people who are like, you know what, I'm busy, I don't want to get the looks, and I can read what I want, and this is the format I prefer. So on one hand, it angers my feminism at the thought of people reading ebook and listening more to audiobooks because they don't want to listen to the judgment. But at the same time, you know what? A lot of these might be working mothers who are busy and just want to go through their day without someone giving them a snotty look over what they choose to read or listen to. So there's two realms of thought on that. And I also think it's probably convenience, ebook and audiobook. You know, you have X amount of busy things to do during the day, but you can slap some headphones on and get your, like you say, if you work a job that's repetitive, you can do that and listen to it. Or if you're home trying to take care of three kids, I mean, good God, you need a break. So whatever the reason is, I'm excited as an author that there are these additional formats available to people to get books and read books. And there's another thought of, well, audio isn't reading. I couldn't disagree more. It is reading. It's just reading in a different way, because that's like saying blind people then don't read. Who would dare utter such an insult? And my sister, who does not like to read the written word, I was telling her earlier, she loves audiobooks. So now I can actually talk with her about books. And for 30 some odd years, I have been unable to do that. So it's so exciting for me on that level too. Just, I can talk to people who are reluctant readers about books thanks to audiobooks. So I'm delighted at the boom in it. It's delivering a story to people who might not otherwise have gotten the story.
And I will also throw in a little side comment that our society now is so multitasking that just getting simply through a day is hardly heard of anymore, and we all carry this, well, I'll speak for myself, from my Norwegian background, that I carry this guilt if I'm not accomplishing something, you know? So for me to sit and read is this sort of guilty luxury, but if I can exercise and read, or do the dishes and read, or, you know, then wow, have I got it going on.
Yeah, okay, then you'll be
I
next.
Think now too, with the advent of WhisperSync, and there's another format of it, that you get your ebook and then you're offered the audio version, and it's, I think, a reduced rate from what you would have paid if you just bought the audio version, that you can be reading along while you're at home, and then when you're in your car, so, oh, now I go to my audio format. And because that's relatively inexpensive, I think that's caused a big boom too.
And it keeps track of your place.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, that's the crazy thing. So it picks up right where you left off reading. In the striped sweater, yes?
Do you readers ever work on more than one project at the same time?
Yes, and it is insane. So I say I don't anymore.
Yes, but not very often, and it is difficult. It's just tiring. This takes an awful lot of mental focus, and it's tiring.
The other thing that, just to add to that, at the end of the recording process, generally what happens is that audio has gone to an editing and proofing team. Sometimes there's two different people, sometimes it's the same person, and I've actually been a proof listener. It's a real job, and that's how I kind of got my way in. You are reading along and listening and making sure that the narrator is reading what's on the page, checking any pronunciations of maybe place names, or, you know, doing a little research and that kind of thing. Then the corrections come back. And so the book is recorded all the way through, and depending on how that process goes for each individual team of people, the corrections are coming back. And the final corrections, of course, come back after the final chapter is recorded. If you're on to the next book, that can be a bit of a challenge, because you're already, your head's in the next book, but you've, in doing the corrections, you might have a sentence that needs to fit in a larger paragraph, and so not only are you in the voice that you need to, that you've created, but have to get somewhat into the emotional state that fits that scene, and you're on to the next book, so that can be a challenge. Another question? Yes? Second row.
For Anne and Elizabeth, dialect. Were you natural mimics, or how would you develop this wonderful talent?
I was a natural mimic, and had a great interest in that growing up. And so it, you know, from being in a children's choir and kind of developing those listening skills really early in terms of hearing differences of nuance. And then I've been teaching voice and acting for 18 years, God. So the best way to learn is to teach. So how do I go about learning it? I know where to go for resources, and the resources are vast now that we have digital availability, and we can click into a radio station across the world or listen to someone on YouTube in an interview and hear how they sound. These resources are wonderfully available for narrators. And I would say it's great to go into a dialect if you feel like you can do it well, or sometimes hint at it, but I guess the question is always how far do I go? And it's better to maybe not do one than do one poorly, because that would take you out of the story. Right, so whatever choices we make have to be choices that will feed the story and help the listener be in that world. And if there's something that comes up, like if I'm continually thinking about, oh, that person is really inconsistent with their dialect, or I'm not buying that then I'm not thinking about the story. I'm out of the story.
And also, that dialect is not character.
The dialect is only part of the whole character. Yeah.
I am a natural mimic. That's what drew me to the whole thing in the first place. Critically, then, it's either been a great success or it isn't, and I don't really know what the difference is. Little B, if I hadn't attempted that Nigerian accent, wouldn't have been the same book, because it was all, you know, even from the blurb on the back, the voice of Little B, it was all about how she spoke. And I do like to do accents, and there was some in Anna and the King of Siam, and that's the book that the King and I is based on, so I did suggest a little bit that Thai accent. And when you see that the King's lines, you know, they're pretty much lifted out into the films. You have his voice, Yul Brynner's voice in your head. There's no getting it out because it's there on the page, you know. So yes, I do like accents, and there's a big, it's a hot issue right now on the internet, isn't it, ladies, about should you or shouldn't you? And I tend to, if I think I can do a good job of it, but it's not all about wearing a funny hat of the accent, if you know what I mean. It can't all be about that. And if I don't think I'm going to do a good job at it, I won't.
Yes?
I read a lot of audiobooks, and I review them on my blog, and sometimes I will read reviews. There's reviews everywhere. You've got Twitter, or this is good, or this is not so good, and Audible. And sometimes I read over the reviews, and I'm thinking, did they read the same audiobook I did? So how do you respond to glowing praise and harsh criticism as a narrator?
Okay, and can we say the name of your blog on our... Literate Housewife, yes? Okay, so you can follow her on Twitter or check out the blog. The question has to do with responding to both praise and criticism from listeners. Yes, and Janine, if you wanna jump in, because I know you have thoughts about that as well.
I think that as an actor, I learned early that you take you accept the praise, and then the ones that are criticisms, you take with a grain of salt, not to dismiss it entirely, but to say, well, okay, well, what about this can I learn from? Is there something that's truthful here? But the fact is, you can't please all the people all the time. And so you just have to keep doing the best you can and trying to improve moment by moment, year by year, without being dragged down by the rejection, because that happens. And if, my God, if we were dragged down by rejection, we wouldn't be doing this work. I mean, not that it doesn't happen. And so that's why it's nice to commiserate with each other sometimes. But definitely, you take what you can learn, and then you have to move on to the next project.
And I just wanted to quickly say, we'll take one more question after this.
So, yeah, the criticism tends to be either it's you're up here or you're down on the ground. There's very little in the middle. And I take it very much to heart, but I can't let it cripple me. And I just try and take, if you see, and there's certain things about yourself you can't change. And I whip myself into every kind of a shape I can. But at the end of the day, you've just got to kind of be at peace with yourself and just say, well, this is my brand and I really am trying.
I don't remember who said works of art are never finished, they're abandoned. Someone far wiser, because I think that most people, whether you're a narrator or a writer or whatever it is you do, it's never going to be good enough for you. And you know, releasing it into the public, it's never going to be good enough for some people either, and really not good enough. Myself, when I first started out, I read every review of my books. And if someone pointed out something that they didn't like, I thought, okay, I'll fix that. And I quickly drove myself crazy. Because it would be like me saying, okay, all of us were going to go on a road trip. Everyone tell me directions how you think the best way to get there. How long before I drive that bus into a ditch? Because I can't stand anymore hearing, no, you take a left. No, it's faster on this street. No, I told you to go back there. That's what it's like when you are the creator of a product. There's countless opinions. I mean, I think I have 18,000 reviews on Goodreads. I couldn't read all of them if I wanted to, and if I did, I would just sit in a room probably rocking and shaking myself. So I have chosen to, at this point, because I found out the hard way, that I don't remember the good things on a personal level with my reviews. I don't remember someone saying, wow, you really nailed it. I remember the one saying, wow, she is a joke as a writer. Any day now her books are going to tank and people are going to realize she can't write her way out of a paper bag. And you get stuff like that. And that person has every right to say it, by the way. There are movies I've seen, The Good Shepherd. I want those 3 hours of my life back, okay? So I don't think it's any flaw of the reviewer when something just totally bombs. It's that experience. It's a personal experience to read, to watch, to listen, and you're going to have a personal reaction. As an author, though, I have stepped back from trying to fix what people don't like. If it's an error of fact, you had 4 characters in this scene. 3 sentences later, there were only 2, you idiot. Yeah, I need to pay attention to that. But if it's, I hate this character and I hate this plot point, you know, I can find 10 other people who, that's why they love the book, and 10 other people who were, I could take it or leave it. You have to write what you love. You have to do the best you can. And then you have to, at least as I'm concerned, walk away, or you will get crippling writer's block. So, and that's just how I've had to handle it.
We have one more question.
You're spending a lot of time talking. It's not like acting where there's dialogue with another person. How do you protect your voice during the hours of recording?
Vocal health for the narrator. Yeah, that's actually a session that we will be able to go to at the upcoming Audio Publishers Association conference.
I'll speak to that. You have to have a good vocal production practice, and it starts with the breath. It really is a whole picture. You have to look at what you eat the day you're going into the studio, what you consume, what you don't consume. I've been fighting off a sinus infection. I think I've been doing it okay. But you definitely have to pace yourself. Some people say, oh, I can't record more than 2 hours in a row, and other people go for 8 hours a day. So people have different limitations, some people are the 50-yard dash and other people are distance runners. But it's definitely a lifestyle choice. And warming up a little bit, warming down afterwards, just with some simple humming, some tongue twisters, drinking lots of water, lots of hydrating. It is something that people don't think about, and it's trying. But for those moms who read chapter books to their kids, especially on a car trip, that can, you get a test there.
Again, I think simple and straightforward. Your voice is like a muscle. If you were using your legs, there's a limit to how far you can walk. There's a limit to how far you can talk, believe it or not, even us women. So it's pacing yourself, and rest is very important so that you get a good night's rest. And all the things that Elizabeth said, and not reaching too deep for very deep men's voices or narrating when you're sick. Because I run into all kinds of problems. And really, again, it boils down to the simple things. You just take care of yourself and you're in for the long haul.
Thank you to Anne, thank you to Janine and Elizabeth for sharing all of this wonderful stuff with us today. Thank you for coming.
This has been Falling Headphones Over Heels, Audiobooks.
with audiobook narrators Anne Flosnick and Elizabeth Wiley, author Janine Frost, and moderator Andy Arndt. Originally presented March 22, 2013. The panel, sponsored by Audio Publishers Association and the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, was part of the 2013 Virginia Festival of the Book in Charlottesville, Virginia. Thanks to Robin Witten and the staff at Audiophile Magazine, Krista Farrell and the Jefferson Madison Regional Library, Nancy Damon and volunteers at Virginia Festival of the Book, and Cheryl Herman and Audio Publishers Association for making this panel possible. Thanks also to the Audio Gals for making this podcast version available to a wider audience.